Have you ever browsed in incognito mode? It's probably not as incognito as you think. Google recently settled a $5 billion lawsuit after being accused of secretly tracking users in incognito mode. Google's defense? Incognito does not mean invisible. In fact, all of your online activity is still 100% visible to a ton of third parties, unless you use ExpressVPN. Third parties like your internet service provider, your mobile network provider, and the admins of your Wi-Fi network, which could be your school, your boss, or your parents, can still see every website you visit, even in incognito mode, but not with ExpressVPN. They reroute all of your traffic through servers that are secure and encrypted, so nobody can poke around and see what you've been up to. ExpressVPN is ridiculously easy to use. It is literally one click and you're protected. It works on a ton of different devices, your phone, your laptop, your tablet, and more, so you can stay protected anywhere. And it's been rated as the best virtual private network by respected tech reviewers like The Verge and CNET. I don't like the idea of anyone spying on my internet activity for all kinds of reasons, so it's important to me personally to use ExpressVPN to make sure my online activity is my own. Here's an example. I recently used ExpressVPN to search for a gift for my wife because I don't want any unexpected ads to pop up across any of my devices and give away what I've been searching for. Protect your online privacy today by visiting expressvpn.com/film. That's expressvpn.com/film, and you can get an extra 3 months free. expressvpn.com/film.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is what's most convenient for you. Care is being here when you need us. We're open evenings and weekends. Care is helping you save more. Most insurance plans and discount cards are accepted at your local Kroger Pharmacy. Care is saving you time by managing your prescriptions online. You can request refills, check order status, and more. Care is convenience that works for everyone. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Services and availability vary by location. Age and other restrictions may apply. For coverage, consult your health insurance company. Visit the pharmacy or our site for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Monday, July 8th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about the latest film and TV news. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film staff writer and box office analyst Ryan Scott.
Hey, everyone. How's it going?
All right, Ryan, I wanted to mention a couple of, obituary type of stories at the top of the show today. Robert Town, one of the greatest screenwriters in Hollywood history, has died at age 89. He wrote Chinatown and Shampoo and the first Mission Impossible movie and The Firm and Days of Thunder and a ton of other stuff. But he also made uncredited contributions to a bunch of films like Bonnie and Clyde and McCabe and Mrs. Miller and The Parallax View and Heaven Can Wait. I mean, this guy just had a huge impact on the new Hollywood era specifically. And just wanted to mention him up at the top of the show. I mean, he'll forever be known, I think, as one of the greatest to ever do it in the history of the industry. So rest in peace to Robert Town. I don't know if you have like any of those movies jump out at you, Ryan, as being like foundational for you as a movie watcher.
I don't know about foundational, but I will say I like Days of Thunder an awful lot. And I mean, look, Chinatown is often cited as the greatest screenplay, you know, ever. I never wanted to be a filmmaker, but if I'm close to anything, it's that, you know, I write for a living and I respect the written word. And I feel like sometimes screenwriters get a little slighted in the process, particularly in movie making, because so much changes. But I feel like a guy like that, I mean, the body of work, the words on the page, you know, those classics really, truly don't exist the same way without him. So, I mean, that's a hell of a career right there. It's nothing but worth looking back at with just, you know, putting some respect on that name for sure.
Yeah, definitely. And speaking of putting respect on a name, John Landau is a name that definitely deserves a lot of respect. He died recently at age 63, just a couple days ago, I think. And he co-produced Honey, I Shrunk the Kids and Dick Tracy before he sort of hooked up with James Cameron and became his producing partner and basically his right-hand man, producing Titanic and Avatar and Alita Battle Angel and Avatar The Way of Water. So I just wanted to give him a shout out as well. He was like a huge, huge part of Cameron's creative life over the past, whatever it's been, 20 something years at this
30,
point.
30 years, over 30 years.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, rest in peace to Robert Towne and John Landau. All right, Ryan, let's get into some news stuff here. Let's talk about the box office. Actually, let's kick off with a top 10 recap of the movies at the box office this past weekend.
Will do. So kicking off things, and we're just going to go over, I'll get into more of this in a minute, but we're just going to go over the pure weekend grosses. So the Friday to Sunday, and I'll go over what things did over the 4th of July and stuff, but we'll start with the 3-day grosses. So Despicable Me 4 topped the charts with an estimated $75 million debut, followed by Inside Out 2 in its fourth weekend, taking in $30 million. A Quiet Place Day 1 followed in number 3, dropped a harsh almost 60%, but still took in $21 million. Maxine, another new one, entered and opened at number 4 with $6.7 million. That is the third entry in Ty West's X trilogy. Bad Boys Ride or Die still hanging around at number 5 with $6.5 million in its fifth weekend. Horizon and American Saga Chapter 1 fell a little more than 50% with a $5.4 million second weekend. Number 7, another one from Angel Studios. This is Sound of Hope, the story of Possum Trot. They're kind of trying to capitalize on the Sound of Freedom from last year. That opened to $3.2 million. Coming at number 8 was one we talked about last week briefly, is Kalki 2898 AD, an Indian import that made $1.8 million in its second weekend, dropping almost 67%. Coming in at number 9 is The Bike Riders with $1.3 million in its third weekend. That one's fallen fast. And coming in at number 10 is Kinds of Kindness with $860,000 in 920 theaters, and not looking good for that one, which we can talk about here in a minute, but its expansion has not been kind to that one. So
yeah, actually, let's talk about that first before we get into some of the 4th of July stuff and some of the bigger movies there, because I was curious about Kinds of Kindness. I really enjoyed Poor Things, and I've been kind of bummed that like the rollout has not even gotten it to the big theaters anywhere close to me. So I just haven't even had the opportunity to see this yet. So like, how would you say this is performing sort of compared to the rollout of Poor Things, which ultimately went on to make like over $100 million, I think.
Well over $100 million worldwide, yeah. So I will say this up top. The good news is that Kinds of Kindness only cost $15 million to make. So it was a much cheaper movie. That said, the rollout has been far less kind. It looked good in the first couple of weekends when it was in a smaller number of theaters. So for example, this weekend it opened, it added 430 screens, ended up on 920 theaters overall, but it dropped almost 46% from the previous weekend when it was on half as many screens. You following? So It only made $934 per screen this weekend. Mm. So I that's just not what you want to see. If you want to look at the bigger picture here, it's at a 3.8 million domestic, 2.7 internationally, 6.5 worldwide right now. I don't see it doing much better than 10, 12 at this point.
Yeah. One of those situations where you think they'll just drop it on VOD? Like maybe
it's going to have to soon
performing as well.
Yeah. I think they're going to have to soon just because it's a smaller movie. I'm not generally in favor of the VOD thing and what it looks like, cause this is already its third weekend. So I would guess they're still going to probably give it a month. You know, they'll probably give it a full month, which I think for a movie this small, I'm fine with that. I think that's okay. You know, I think you give it a shake, and if it doesn't work out, okay. You know, yeah. that theatrical release ultimately promotes the VOD release, which is something I talk about all the time. It was the IFC business model. It remains the Magnolia Pictures business model. It's a viable business model. It's fine. It's just all relative to the kind of movie. But I also think that, you know, Poor Things did really well. Yorgos, Emma Stone, these are people you'd like to keep happy. This is a movie that it might actually still hang around till the Oscar race. Like, Jesse Plemons won, I believe, what was that at Cannes that he won, like, Best Actor, I believe, for this movie.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah, I didn't hear about that.
So I think this is one that over the life of it could still, you know, but even if it just kind of breaks even, becomes, you know, a nice one to have on Hulu, like, because they didn't spend a fortune on it, Disney can easily bear, you know, a $15 million movie that breaks even just to keep a couple of, you know, A-listers happy, you know, like that. That's not bad business there. Like, it's, you know, it's not great for business, sure, but it's not bad business. So I guess that's kind of like my broader picture. It doesn't look great theatrically, but I also think the broader picture for this one is more or less fine. And I think as long as these kinds of movies aren't losing a fortune, the Disney and Warner Brothers and they'll continue to make them, because you can't just keep making, you know, franchise stuff. You gotta go for awards and stuff as well. So
yeah,
you know, that's my take.
Okay, so let's jump up to the top of that list that you just rattled off there, and tell me about these movies and how they did, and then also, yeah, factor in some of the July 4th stuff for me too.
Well, yeah, so let's talk about Despicable Me 4 here. Look, I don't much care about these movies, and I get the sense that a lot of our listeners, unless you have kids, you know, like, might not be, but I think it's worth putting some respect on this franchise at this point, and let me lay out why. So, $75 million over the 3-day, excellent. But over the full, it opened on Wednesday of last week to kind of get in on the 4th of July weekend, $122.6 million across that 5-day stretch. And a $106.9 million international debut. So we're looking at $230 million across that first 5 days. You know, and so you're already looking at, you know, this movie's set up for success. It's probably not going to get to Minions Rise of Gru levels, which made, you know, $939 million in 2022, had $107 million opening. You know, that was a little bigger, but I think the Minions name at this point is a little bigger than the Despicable Me name. Mm-hmm. But this movie is easily going to get to 500, 600, you know, and Illumination and Universal have not spent more than $80 million on any one of these movies. They might have spent a little more on this one for the voice cast, but let's say it's even $100 million. That's a huge win. At this point, the franchise as a whole is just shy of $4.9 billion worldwide. It is the biggest animated franchise of all time. It now has more number one debuts than any other animated franchise, topping Shrek. It will be a $5 billion franchise probably within a week. So, you know, look, these movies aren't for me. It's clearly good for cinema on some level. People enjoy them. We saw young adults going to Minions Rise of Gru in droves. Like, it's getting more than kids out to theaters. I just, because it's an example to me of, just because something is not for you does not mean it's a bad thing. And so I don't know. I mean, look, at this point, like, the way things have been going, with, you know, the uncertainty at the box office and stuff, and the fact that Illumination and Universal can keep these budgets reasonable, and that allows them to make movies like Migration, which can become a success with $300 million worldwide on a $75-ish million budget. But more importantly, your Despicable Me 4s will prop up the next original movie from Illumination. So, you know, in some way it helps support original cinema, and I am all for that. But if nothing else, another stellar debut for Gru and the Minions, and, you know, who am I to talk shit?
Like, I guess that's what I'm saying. Right. Yeah. I mean, I have not seen any of these movies either. I'm basically in the exact same boat that you are here. So I don't really have anything to add. I think you said that very well. All right. What other things jumped out at you from that top 10?
The biggest thing that jumped out to me, and what we really need to talk about for a second, is Inside Out 2 and its fourth weekend. It dropped less than 50%. It dropped 48% on its fourth weekend after losing 680 theaters. And as another gigantic family-friendly animated franchise film topped the charts. So, did not drop like a rock, still held well, made $30 million. Now let's talk about where Inside Out 2 is now, after 24 days in theaters. Now, as we're recording this podcast, we'll get Monday grosses, things like that, so this will change. But as of 24 days in theaters, Inside Out 2 has made $1.216 billion worldwide. And that is $533.8 million domestic and $683.1 million internationally. Where does that put us? With Inside Out 2, after just 24 days, being one of the top 25 highest grossing movies of all time.
That's insane, Ryan.
It just passed the entire gross of Iron Man 3. I want you to try to transport yourself back to 2013 and remember how big Iron Man 3 felt. Because I remember that felt like, you know, because that was coming off of phase one of the MCU. It was as big as Marvel ever felt. Yeah. And Inside Out 2 in 24 days has, now this is unadjusted for inflation, but still, you know, it passed Minions. It passed Captain America Civil War. It passed Aquaman. It's passed Skyfall. This movie's made more than Skyfall, the biggest James Bond movie of all time. And it's rocketing up the charts. So, you know, it is by the end of today, going to pass The Fate of the Furious, and it is going to pass Incredibles 2 to become Pixar's biggest movie ever.
Man.
From there, you get up to Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom at $1.3 billion to enter the top 20 all-time, which it'll do by the end of this week.
I mean, we always talk about, like, adjusted for inflation, and the movie that always gets brought up in those comps is, like, Gone with the Wind and, you know, like, the original Star Wars and stuff like that. You know, movies that were, you know, decades and decades and decades old. But like you're saying, Iron Man 3, that was 2013. That was just over 10 years ago. You know, like we were doing this job basically, like, or I was anyway, and like writing about movies and very much like involved in the culture. So it just feels different when the comparison point is something that was only 10 years ago. I mean, I know culture has changed and a lot has changed in the movie world since then. But let's talk about
closer things. So let's talk about where it's going to go, because this movie's not at all done. Disney's committed to, I believe, a 100-day theatrical run. So let's talk about that. There's no question now that, like, even if it started to collapse, it's going to get to $1.4 billion. But it seems like $1.5 billion is more or less locked. So let's talk about what that means. It will then get somewhere around the top 11 worldwide. It will pass the Super Mario Brothers movie. It will pass Barbie. And it will maybe pass Top Gun Maverick to become the third biggest movie of the pandemic era. For reference, Top Gun Maverick made $1.49 billion worldwide. So it's going to get close to that, probably.
Yeah, that's a great point, because Top Gun Maverick, there was such an energy around that movie. And like that was, I mean, there were so many stories about how it saved cinema and it brought all these different people back out to theaters and all that kind of stuff. And like the energy and the momentum of that movie was so palpable. And like, I understand that Inside Out 2 is doing insanely well right now, but that energy, I think it's fair to say, is not there in
the conversation around the movie, the way we talk about it. 2022 was when things still felt very uncertain. Like, because 2021, it's like, okay, we know things are getting a little better, but like, can it really get better? And Top Gun Maverick really was, because like Spider-Man No Way Home did what it did. And we'll talk about that in a second. But like Spider-Man No Way Home did what it did. And it's like, well, that's Marvel. That's okay, fine. Like this is the first thing that felt big after Endgame, whatever. But Top Gun Maverick, I mean, if that movie had made $500 million worldwide, all of us would have called it a huge success. That was the one where we're like, oh, a movie can still do this. Mm-hmm. So that was 2022. So that felt a little different. But then even let's talk about Barbie last year, how big that felt and how big Mario felt. And this movie's just going to sail by them like it was nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and that to me is totally nuts.
But that to me is the Pixar of old coming back to bear. You know, that's what it used to, because Incredibles 2, we talked about this, and I don't mean to talk anything bad about Incredibles 2, but Incredibles 2 did not, people don't talk about it the way they talk about the first Incredibles, yet it just breezed its way to $1.2 billion.
Right.
You know, is the same sort of thing. So that to me is the power of Pixar. It always has been, you know, at its best. So that to me is where this gets incredible. So what we're looking at is if this goes to the $1.5 billion range, it could crack the top 10 all time. And what it needs to do to do that is beat the Avengers and do more than $1.52 billion, which if you were to ask me to bet on it, I would bet that that will happen. And Inside Out 2 passing the Avengers to me is just crazy. You know, that is just, you know, so that is another one for me personally where I go like, wow. So then the only other two movies of the pandemic era that would have made more money are the aforementioned Spider-Man No Way Home, which made $1.92 billion, and then Avatar The Way of Water, which made $2.32 billion. And just to bring things back around for a second, Mr. John Landau, who we talked about, producer of Titanic, Avatar The Way of Water, and Avatar 3, of the four highest grossing movies of all time. Those, you know, James Cameron, sure, director of those movies. Those movies don't happen without John Landau. So just since we're talking about the biggest movies of all time, we're circling back to Landau there. But for people that might understand that, like, Inside Out 2 is doing well, like, because there isn't that palpable buzz around it, I am trying to impress upon people how insanely impressive this is and how good this is. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's really important to sort of, like, really get out there, even as Despicable Me 4 comes out, even as Summer, you know, that's so awesome. I think that's really important to not get lost in the conversation.
Yeah, that's great. So I want to talk to you a little bit about the Paramount merger. Did you have any other box office stuff you wanted to mention?
Just real quick, Maxine coming in at number four there, the third entry in the X trilogy after X and Pearl. It more than doubled the opening weekend of Pearl. And now Ty West made Pearl and X for $1 million each. They, you know, Pearl made about a little less than $10 million worldwide. X made $14 million. They were modest, you know, like modest hits, but, you know, did well on streaming, VOD, whatever. That allowed Ty West to get a bigger budget for Maxine. Look, it's not going to be a huge hit or anything, but, like, it's kind of a cool proof of concept, you know, that, like, you know, that Ty West was able to kind of pull this off. And I think it's kind of a nice little victory lap for him and Mia Goth and the whole team. And, you know, it's a nice little horror win after a kind of rough start to the year. So I just wanted to point that out, that even though it's a small number, it is kind of it's good in context. And so, you know, we can end there. But that's at least wanted to touch on that since it opened this weekend.
Okay, cool. Yeah, and people can go back and listen to Friday's episode of the show where BJ and I talk about Maxine. We have a spoiler discussion about that. Okay, so the Paramount merger is finally official now with Skydance. There was, I think I had you on the show and we talked about, this was weeks, if not months ago at this point, where it was like, yep, it looks like this is going to go through.
Well, and then it was almost exactly a month ago. Okay. I looked back as I was writing this up this morning.
And then it seemed that deal basically fell through, and it seemed like there were a lot of questions about, okay, if this Skydance merger with Paramount, which we've talked about already on the show, so I don't want to, like, retread the same exact ground and, like, go over all of that. People can go back and listen to our previous episode if they want, like, the full context. But we were like, wow, if this Skydance merger isn't happening, what the hell is going to happen to Paramount? Like, what is going to happen to this big studio? And there were a lot of question marks around that. And now, finally, Skydance kind of came back in out of nowhere almost. And the deal happened and was, like, essentially finalized this past weekend, which is kind of unusual, I think. And so now this is like, really, truly happening. So, like, what's the big takeaway you have here, Ryan?
Well, for one, Skydance was clearly still the best suitor. Basically, what ended up happening is, like, I think ultimately, so I wrote almost 1,000 words on this morning, and I still felt like I was just, like, speeding through all of the bullet points. Because I, like, for people that don't follow this all the time, there's a lot to talk about. But Sherry Redstone is kind of the very head of the company, and there's this parent company called National Amusements that ultimately owns Paramount. So Sherry Redstone is kind of the be all end all here. She's the controlling shareholder. And my understanding is last time she kind of vetoed the deal at the last second. And what happened is Skydance had to circle back and sort of sweeten the pot. People were pissed when Sherry kind of pulled the rug out at the, because, you know, this needs to happen. Paramount essentially needs a partner to survive is basically what we're looking at. And so what happened is, Skydance came back, sweetened the pot. So what's happening is it's like an all stock deal. My calculation, it's about an $8.4 billion deal overall, which is just about $100 million less than Amazon paid for MGM in 2022. So it's in the same ballpark, which is crazy for me to think of Paramount in the same, like, I would have thought of Paramount as much bigger than MGM, you know, but that just tells you how much has happened in the past couple of years. So it also tells you why Paramount needed this deal. But so basically what's going to happen is this is a proper merger. It's not an acquisition. And there is a slight difference there where you have Amazon acquiring MGM, where Amazon just pays and says, you're mine now. Whereas this is more Skydance and Paramount like joining forces. You know, it is slightly meaningful in that there's a difference there. So basically, you know, they're Skydance with Redbird, they're going to acquire National Amusements and then, you know, do some stock deal. It's a little complicated, but they're also going to add like a $1.5 billion to, you know, decrease Paramount's balance sheet and try to make the finances look a little better. The only caveat here is Paramount has what is called a go shop period of 45 days, which means they can field a better offer. And so there's a chance someone could come forward with a better offer that they like more. And this sort of happened when the Disney Fox deal happened. Disney had put together, I think, a $57 billion offer. I think it was Comcast at the time came forward with like a much bigger all cash offer, and then Disney had to up their offer. So this does mm-hmm. happen sometimes. But given that Sony had offered a much richer acquisition price, and Paramount didn't go for it, I'm of the belief that this will go. I don't think that go shop period will. But so basically my biggest takeaway at the end of this is that this is the best situation to come out of a bad situation. Paramount most likely was not going to survive if it went out on its own. The way that the industry is going, consolidation was going to be necessary. They needed a little bit more financial security. They needed some different leadership. And I think this is going to do that. It's better than Sony buying Paramount. It's better than Warner Brothers Discovery buying Paramount. Both of those were things that were floated. What that would have done is taken the number of major Hollywood studios left from 5 to 4, which mm-hmm. would have been very bad for moviegoers, TV lovers, you know, so that would have been bad. This might be better for the streaming wars in the end. This might be better for TV and what's left of it in the end. This is definitely going to be better for movies in the end. It doesn't decrease that Hollywood studio, and it gives Paramount a better shot at securing a future. So I think for the average viewer, for the average person that likes this stuff, this is the best scenario. Are a bunch of jobs going to be lost? Yeah, absolutely. Are changes going to happen? You bet. BET is going to be sold probably tomorrow. You know, like, so some of these things, they matter, but it is still better than some of the alternatives that we're facing down. And, you know, I think it's good that it's at least finally done and we can start talking about what that might mean. They can start going through some of the regulatory approval process. But I guess my biggest takeaway is that, like, even if some of this starts to seem shitty as things roll on, it's definitely less shitty than what would have happened otherwise, I guess, is my best takeaway from this.
Yeah. Yeah. My understanding is that, like, if Warner Brothers, for example, had acquired Paramount or merged with them or whatever, then, like, the number of jobs lost would have been gargantuan compared to.
It would have
to
been catastrophic. And also, let's not forget, over the last 2 years, how much messiness we've had to deal with that Paramount Discovery, or with that Warner Brothers Discovery merger. Can you imagine them merging with Paramount now? I mean, anyone that Warner Brothers who survived like the AT&T deal and everything and was dealing with another merger, like, I can't even imagine, you know? Yeah. So better than that, certainly.
Yeah. David Ellison, who's the CEO of Skydance, is supposed to be the new CEO of Paramount, whatever they, and they may end up changing the name of the company from what I read. So we'll see about that.
They can't really start doing that stuff until like the regulatory approval. And David Ellison is going to, what did he say? He's essentially going to be the head of the company is what it looks like. And David Ellison has a good track record. So, you know, we'll see.
Yeah. He produced some of the most recent Mission Impossible movies. He produced some of the Star Trek films, the J.J. Abrams ones, the
Top Gun Maverick he was involved with.
Top Gun Maverick as well.
And again, he started Skydance, which is very successful. Skydance has had a very long relationship with Paramount. Like, they've produced a ton of movies together. So this makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And David Ellison's dad, Larry Ellison, is the founder of Oracle. He's like one of the richest men on the planet. So there's a lot of money, I guess, that they have access to if they need it. Jeff Shell, who used to run NBC Universal, is going to be coming on board as president. I think he was ousted from NBC Universal due to like some sexual harassment stuff. So that's like not great that he's being brought back into the fold as far as, you know, my like 30,000 foot view of this whole situation. But anyway, if this deal actually, I guess, goes over those regulatory hurdles that you were talking about, it sounds like all these changes that are actually going to be taking place won't go into effect until like sometime late next year. So it is just kind of broadly speaking, a nice breath of relief or whatever to know that Paramount is not going to be just chipped away to be like a shell of its former self.
Right. So. And just for us to at least understand like what the hell is going to happen here. Like, you know, because we were really kind of left hanging. And I think, again, the biggest thing I would look for if you're a viewer of this stuff, you know, Paramount owns a lot of stuff. So I would look, like I said, BET, I would think is going to be sold very, very soon. I think MTV could suffer a similar fate, potentially. So some of these other like fringe assets that Paramount owns, I would look for those to be sold soon. So it may be not totally sold for parts, but some of those parts are going away.
Yeah. All right, so we're running way over on time here. I just wanted to mention that we've mentioned Top Gun Maverick a couple times in this podcast episode. Joseph Kosinski was the director of Top Gun Maverick. His next movie is called F1. It's a Formula One racing movie starring Brad Pitt. And the trailer for that came out the other day, I think yesterday. So we've written that up at Slash Film. I'm going to link to that in the show notes if people want to check that out. It very much looks like Top Gun Maverick, but in a race car instead of a fighter jet or whatever. So check that out if you were one of the however many people who actually went and saw and enjoyed Top Gun Maverick in theaters, because this could be a very, very similar type of thing. All right, let's take a break and then we'll come back and answer a couple of listener emails.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Synovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Synovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
All right, Ryan, I wanted to mention a couple of these emails here. Julie wrote in. She was reacting to a conversation that BJ and I had on Friday's episode of the show, talking about theaters and watching things at home and the theatrical experience, basically. She says, love your show. I think the major reason people don't go to chain theaters is not how big our TVs are or that everything is streaming, but the number of screens we have. We have 2 TVs, 2 laptops, and 2 cell phones for 2 people. And all of them have been used to watch movies. When I was a kid in the 70s, we had 1 TV in our living room that was controlled by my brother and my parents. If I wanted to watch anything else, I had to go to a movie theater. So when Bad News Bears came out, I saw it in the big chain theater 11 times. I love movies now, but I do prefer one of the many repertory theaters we have here in Portland, Oregon. People are respectful and they serve beer and wine and cider and pizza without being expensive. I hardly ever go to our local chain theater, which is a pretty nice Regal. And when I do, there are usually about 5 other people in the theater and I never buy any concessions because it's too expensive. I can't imagine it will be open much longer. So thanks for writing that in, Julie. There are a couple things that I wanted to talk to you about, Ryan. So first of all, I think Julie might be onto something with that everybody has multiple screens point as a factor in why theaters no longer have the same cultural power that they once did. That's kind of like an under-discussed element in all of this. I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that part of the email.
I think Parks and Rec had a phenomenal joke about that about 7 or 8 years ago. There was that Jason Schwartzman ran like the video store in town and they had like some screening of some art house movie. And he announced like, oh, we're having to close. And you know, Leslie Knope, of course, tries to save it. And the guy in the audience is like, I'm watching Iron Man 3 on my phone right now. Like, he's just like, he's literally just like, you know, that's absolutely a factor. And look, we've talked a lot about the pricing thing. Julie, you are not wrong. These things are expensive, and I love repertory theaters. I talk about the Paramount Theater in Austin all the time now. Fortunately, due to some car trouble yesterday, I had to miss watching Point Break at that theater yesterday, and I am devastated about it.
But I
would have loved to have sat there with my popcorn and my soda that was reasonably enough priced with a $10 ticket to watch Point Break in a beautiful theater. Like, those are experiences I love, even as someone who goes to chains. But I've also mentioned this for a while. Regal, their parent company, is in the midst of bankruptcy, so they may not be around much longer. That one, you're right. And these are existential things that these chain theaters are having to figure out, because people are increasingly going for that unique experience that is reasonably priced. And so, yeah, I do think that the industry has got to sort of figure out a way to make that stuff feel more special again. And you can't just have this cookie cutter, crappy theater experience anymore. And I hate to denigrate, you know, Regal, because I've liked Regal for a long time, but like, that model just can't work anymore. So, I do think that that's correct. And I think that you have to offer a reason to just not watch whatever the hell movie is out on your phone 3 weeks later when it hits streaming.
The expensive concessions thing is a big part of that email too, that I wanted to talk to you about. Like, I know theaters make a huge percentage of their money from concessions, so I expect there to be a markup of some kind, but the prices are getting pretty out of control. Like, a friend texted me last week and he was like, the free popcorn and drink that you get for your birthday at AMC rings up as $17.
Yeah.
And like, it's cool that AMC does the birthday giveaway at all, but yeesh, like that is a lot of money for that.
And that actually sounds low to me.
Wow. Okay.
Like, well, because I remember, because every once in a while I have a press screening out here at AMC, and sometimes I just want like a soda, and I go up there and I'm like, and the small, what pisses me off, and if anyone from AMC is listening, yeah, I'm actually gonna like call you out. Like, your small soda's like, I understand in America we're spoiled, we have big things, but a small soda's got to be like 8 ounces, and then like a medium is like 56. You know, it's just like there's no, and the small soda is like $6, and then the medium's like $7. It's crazy how expensive it is. And yeah, I don't know. I agree. And I, so this is also partially where I get into where I agree with Sony's Tom Rothman here, that you got to make tickets cheaper, and you got to, okay, fine, I understand concessions have to be expensive, whatever, but you got to ease that blow somehow. You got to,
I was wondering if you think that the chains might end up lowering their concession prices at all as a way to lure people back in.
I don't think they can. Everyone I've talked to, and the little bit of experience I have with some smaller theaters out here, I just don't think you can. Like, I literally think that's the only way they're making it. You know, she's talking, there's 5 people at Regal. How much money you think they're making from that theater? If those people,
not a lot.
If they're buying, they gotta buy beer, they gotta buy wine, they gotta buy pizza, they gotta buy popcorn. It's the only way they can even keep the lights on, you know? Yeah. And so again, this is a bigger problem. Like, it shouldn't be that because again, this is when things start to spiral out of control. This happened in the music industry, all this stuff where, you know, you start price gouging because you only have a handful of people there and it's the only way you can keep the lights on. That is not sustainable. So, you know, like, I agree that it is, but yeah, a $17 popcorn, kind of why I like the Alamo Drafthouse model, where am I going to pay a lot for that pizza? Yeah, relative to what it is. Is it still pretty good pizza? Yeah. So, you know, I can get a club soda that they don't charge me for and a pizza, and it's the same price as going to AMC to get a, you know, kind of crappy popcorn and a needlessly large soda. So,
yeah,
you know.
Okay, so there's one more listener email here. Donnie from Florida writes in, I love the podcast. I've been listening for years. Shout out to Peter and White Train Bowie. I still miss hearing them. My question is, how do you find things to watch on streaming services? I noticed the menus are just awful. We can only find the current 8 to 10 things that particular streaming service is pushing at the time. Is there a site or a system that you or anyone else at Slash Film uses to find the needles in the haystack of horrible streaming service menus? If Ryan happens to be on the episode, can he explain how the heck Peacock is still a thing? Ryan, I honestly don't think we have time for you to get in this unless you have like,
no, I actually do have response. I can make this quick.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, first off, I haven't laughed at one in a while so hard, but first off, I don't have an answer for you for this. This happened to me the other day where I got so frustrated flipping through menus, I just grabbed my Chucky box set and watched Bride of Chucky and fell asleep on the couch. 10 out of 10 would do it again. so, look, I this is one of my biggest, like, streaming has got to figure this out. There is no good way right now, or at least I have not found one. I spend more time flipping around on Netflix than I do actually watching anything on Netflix anymore.
Oh, that pains me to hear, because I think a lot of people have that experience.
It does. And so this is a huge thing that needs to be solved. The burden of choice is a real thing. And there are studies that have been done on this. So streaming, it's great. I wouldn't want to go back to only having cable channels to flip around on. But cable did have that thing of taking some of that burden of choice out of the way. So I will say Peacock. Can I explain how the heck Peacock is still a thing? It's the pot committed theory, I think. If you're a regular listener to this podcast, as I believe you are, Donnie, you might know that I have been hard on Peacock, and I have suggested Peacock should fold for some time, and I have suggested that they will be the one to not survive the streaming wars. I still believe that, and I believe NBC Universal and Comcast stockholders would be very happy if they just shut down Peacock tomorrow. I will say this. It's a thing now. I don't think it's going to be a thing in 3 years. Mm-hmm. Or it's going to merge with another streaming service. It won't exist as it is now. It can't. It's just I don't know. The TED TV show can't possibly do well enough to keep it alive. So that's all I'll say. It shouldn't be a thing. I understand why it is, because NBC Universal said, we're going to try to be part of this streaming wars rather than go the Sony route. And now they've spent billions of dollars to try to get there. So I get it, but it needs to go away.
Yeah, cutting through the noise is really tough. Like, we have articles on Slash Film for how to watch pretty much every big movie at home as soon as that information becomes available. So I would encourage people to keep an eye on the site for information like that. We also write about the best movies and TV shows that are coming and going from Netflix every month, where we highlight a few things that are worth seeking out. And then Chris Evangelista writes a best horror movies streaming this month column every month on the site too. So we try to give people several ways to find good stuff directly. When it comes to like a Friday night after a long week and you're in the mood to watch something at home, like, Ryan, it sounds like you just fired up a box set that you owned, but like on a typical, you know, let's say whatever, two Fridays from now, and you're not going out to the theater, like literally, what do you do when you have time to watch something? Like what steps do you take?
Yeah. So luckily, I think the only good fortune of my time lately is that I have so little expendable free time. So like, I will know for sure that like, you know, there's something on Shudder, for example, that like a new thing on Shudder dropped that I'm like, oh, I definitely want to watch this. And I know I want to watch this. And so I pretty much only have time to do that. Or I will have bought, like, I still have my Abyss 4K Blu-ray that I bought and I'm dying to watch. And so like, I have my little stack of Blu-rays that are like by my TV that are like more like I bought these and I know I want to watch these soon. So, you know, that's tends to be what I do. Like, I'll go to that and I won't spend as much time just flipping around anymore. I just don't really have the time or patience for it. So it's got to be something that I know. And luckily, I don't watch a ton of TV either. So if I do, I'm watching like, you know, The Simpsons or Easy Watch, stuff like that. And I know where that is. But yeah, I just don't waste that much time anymore. I just can't. And, you know, if the algorithms were better, if there was a better way, I might. But at this point, I just don't have the patience for it. I don't know, but what about you? Because it's been a lot of me talking. Do you have a solution for this? Because I would love to hear it.
Well, I don't know if it's a full-blown solution, but it seems to work for me. I have a running list of movies that I'm interested in watching. So like whenever I stumble across a movie that sounds interesting, whether it's from reading about it or if I hear somebody mention a movie on a podcast that I've never seen, or you know, if it has like a star in it that I like that I've never heard of or something like that, I just add it to this ongoing note in my phone. And then when my wife and I are ready to watch something at night, I'll scroll through that and try to find something from there instead of just endlessly scrolling through all the surfaces that I subscribe to. But that's not a foolproof plan. Like sometimes nothing will jump out at me from that list. And when that happens, I typically try to just keep things somewhat focused and like scroll through a specific genre, like thrillers or comedies or whatever we're in the mood for that night. So yeah, that's my way of trying to get around this. But my, if you saw this note right now, you would, like, your jaw would drop because there's like hundreds of movies on it right now. So like it, sometimes that becomes, you know, I have to like take 10 minutes to like scroll through this whole thing and like figure, remind myself like what these movies are and all of that. So I would say if you're going to adopt this method, one thing that I would recommend that I need to start doing myself is when I write down the name of that movie, either write a couple of phrases describing what it is and who's in it or something like that, or maybe like where you heard about it. So you aren't confronted with 100+ titles that you don't recognize and have to research each one when you could be using that time to watch something instead.
So. I hate that like our answer to this is that you need an Excel fucking spreadsheet.
Yeah.
Just to like,
seriously.
Cause I have a note in my phone that's similar, but every time I'm like, oh, I don't have time to figure out where one of these is streaming, and it's just like when I finally find one that sounds interesting and I go to the Amazon Fire search bar and it's like $8 to rent it, I'm like, forget it.
Yeah.
Just like, yeah, that's not a good solution.
I still am a cable subscriber, and so I've found a ton of great stuff to watch on Turner Classic Movies and like movie channels like IFC and AMC and stuff like that. But Turner
Classic IFC's Movies great.
I would really, really recommend, especially if people are still cable subscribers out there and you have access to TCM, like use that. You know, there's so much great stuff that comes through there. And I will, if I have a spare, I don't know, 10 minutes or something, I'll just like go to the TCM channel on my cable guide or whatever through my remote and just look at like every movie that's coming up for the next week or something and just scroll through. And like if any title jumps out at me or little, you know, they show like a 2-sentence synopsis of what the movie's about. If any of that stuff interests me, I'll just record stuff off there. So I have a huge backlog of movies that I've recorded from there that also gives me an opportunity when I finally have some free time to sit down and watch something. I can just scroll through that real quick and see if something immediately jumps out at me there. But again, like it's not a foolproof thing, but I would just recommend making use of the cable channels that you do subscribe to, because there are so many great movies that come through there that I feel like a lot of people are just like, oh, what's on Netflix, whatever. And they kind of forget about all the classic stuff that's easily accessible. Yeah.
I will say two things real quick, as you reminded me, circling back to the Paramount merger, oddly enough, Pluto TV. If you don't use Pluto TV, it is the closest thing to cable that exists, I think. And it's free. And it's available everywhere, and they have like hundreds upon hundreds of these curated channels and a lot of movie channels. So if you're in the mood to just like let something hit you in the face, Pluto TV cannot. And same thing, if you like horror movies, Shudder, one of the great things about it, it's cheap first off, but then they also, when you open it up, they have three constant streaming channels. I think Slashix, which is like classics, but slashers. And then they have like the, it came from Shudder, and they have like three constantly streaming. They just curate, you just turn it on and whatever's on, you just watch it. So I would say that, like, to Ben's point, even if you don't want to pay for cable, there's kind of stuff out there that serves that purpose. So yeah, I would say like Pluto TV is a really good, if you just like, don't feel like dealing with it, that's a good answer. So.
Excellent. Okay. Well, yeah, I would love to know from our listeners what all of your approaches are to how to get through the morass of potential options out there. If anybody has any tactics or techniques or anything, share them on the podcast or send them to us and I'll read them aloud, just to potentially help other people figure out a way to find recommendations in this hellscape that we find ourselves in. So I think that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find a lot more about most of the topics that we talked about linked in the show notes here. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features that you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review this podcast on Apple or Spotify. That really does help us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you all tomorrow.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.